This is the Blaze Radio On Demand.
My name is Henry Crossman. I'm 71 years old, a farmer, and I got a beef to pick with my banker. You see, I recently watched a video that showed how my banker is making about 30 times more interest on my money than what they pay me. On my own darn money. And here's the kicker. This is a perk you, me, and almost all regular Americans can take advantage of, too. Here's how it works. Say I put $1,000 in the bank. These bankers then funnel some of the money into a little-known account that earns 5% tax-free. But little guys like us never hear about it. So the net result is they make 5%, we get horse dung in return. That's why I'm taking a stand. I just watched a video where bankershidemoney.com. They talk about how we can grab these higher tax-free returns for ourselves. So do yourself a favor. Write down this address. www.bankershidemoney.com. That's www.bankershidemoney.com. Don't let your banker screw you over.
Now, spreading freedom across the nation, this is
3, 2, 1.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, thank you so much for joining me. I know that many of you listened in yesterday as I had the pleasure and the privilege of filling in for Rush Limbaugh on the EIB network. Second time in less than a week, obviously very exciting for me, a great day. Was able to do the show without struggling through laryngitis, which I can tell you makes the whole process a bit more enjoyable and more fun. I had a great time Friday, but yesterday was really, I don't want to say the word epic, but I can't think of anything better, so I'm going to have to just go with the E word and say that it was epic. But thank you so much, all of you, for listening in, for sending me supportive emails and tweets and messages on Facebook and all the rest. It was awesome. As you can see, and as you know, Team Buck is growing by leaps and bounds, and that only happens because you listen to this show and you tell people about this show. So I am in your debt. And El Rushbo, as I understand it, is back in action today in his seat. So all is well. All is well in the world of freedom spreading. Now, today, what do we have to cover? A lot of things. And I'm sure this is going to be one of these days where I get to the end of hour two and I've got about five or six big topics left in mind that I'd like to hit. But first, there's something that's come up on CNN, and it's actually not a bit of possible debris from the plane that has not been found. They've actually managed to do some decent journalism apart from trying to just keep the ratings going with the search for the missing flight. And this, I think, is something that illustrates much broader issues and problems for us when we talk about government. Often here on this show, I speak to you about the scope of the federal government, about why it is intrusive and why it is inherently problematic from the perspective of maximizing liberty to have a federal government that can essentially do whatever it wants. This was contra the original intent of the founding. It is against both the words and intent of the Constitution. But what does that really mean? I think there are people now who start to think, because of the constant drumbeat of left-wing interests and progressive ideology in the media, maybe government is your friend. Maybe it's your pal. It wants to give you a hug, a high five. You're going to get along just great. If we only just gave it a little more leeway, it would make things so much better for us all. There's no reason for us to be so frightened of what the government's going to do. Well, if you have that moment of doubt, if you're ever questioning your liberty-based philosophy, you start to think, well, what? And I doubt you do, but let's just walk down this path for a second. You think to yourself, government probably could be better, and maybe if we did things differently, it would be better. It has to perhaps be bigger, and it's only a question of getting us to that place where it can do all the wonderful things it wants to do for us. People make that argument. In fact, that's the primary ideological position of the Democrat Party. It's the primary ideological position of the American left, that government can solve all problems and therefore needs all the power necessary to solve those problems which of course means the elimination of individual choice and rights and freedom in that process. But then you get the trade-off, right? They're going to make things better for you. They're going to give you a house and food and health care and a utopianistic philosophy, a utopian philosophy. That's what they promise. And CNN has this piece, and I'm surprised to see it on CNN because, as we've discussed, they seem to be really a one-trick pony these days, looking at only one issue for the most part, but they're expanding a little bit. And I have to give them credit where it's due. They've done an investigative piece that looks at VA hospitals, specifically a VA hospital in Phoenix. And the short version of what's going on here is that, according to this investigative piece on CNN, and it's been in several sessions of this, several iterations of this same investigative report, that there are lists that have been made in this Phoenix Veterans Affairs healthcare facility. Two lists. One is the list that goes to Washington, D.C., to the top-level bureaucrats, to the heads of the VA, showing them that people who have served their country and who therefore we have a sacred obligation to provide with the benefits promised them in exchange for their service, for being willing to wear the uniform and, if need be, charge the hill, face the machine guns, risk their lives, perhaps even give their lives. That's the deal that was made. And it's a sacred one between the American people and those who wear the uniform, our veterans. And so you would think that if at any place government would want to show itself as being both competent and caring, if government was going to prove to us, especially at a time when we have so many questions about healthcare policy and what's going to come of our healthcare under Obamacare, that not only is this an instance where the government is providing citizens, of course, with services in the form of healthcare, but it is fulfilling this obligation, this irrevocable obligation that we have to veterans to take care of them because they have given for us. And what this CNN report shows is that there were two lists from this Phoenix VA hospital. One list was saying that things were going great. They were getting people the care they needed. They were pushing things along in a very efficient, almost Prussian fashion. Just, you know, yes, we're day after day. We'll get them in. We'll see them. Everything's fine. They're getting the treatment they deserve. The treatment, not just that they deserve, they were promised. This is not something the government is doing just out of some sense of generosity. This is something the government is doing as an obligation and doing it on behalf of the American people who actually have that obligation to the veterans. And what we see is that that list was a fraud. It was a sham. It was one big lie. It was intended to hide the fact that 1,400 to 1,600 sick veterans were forced to wait months to see a doctor. And this is according to a recently retired top VA doctor and several high-level sources. Now, before I get into what this meant for some of those veterans, and I think that it's necessary to tell some of the stories to actually understand what the human costs were to those that we, again, hold not just some basic obligation to, but our highest obligation. As a state, as a polity, as a political entity, we have to support and take care of those who defend us, who stand on the wall. Otherwise, who will do it? Otherwise, who are we? What moral authority do we have to ask anyone, to put anyone in the position where they might have to give their life or for their country if we're not willing to make good on our obligations? But you wonder, well, how could this be in this day of Facebook and Twitter and social media and all this stuff? There's so many ways to get the message out. It's so easy, really, to tell a story and have people pick up on it and have the truth spread around. Why wouldn't doctors in this hospital, administrators in this hospital, come out and say, this is wrong? Well, in this piece, they say part of it is that, as with any bureaucracy, what happens is that the bureaucracy becomes ossified. It becomes sclerotic. It changes. All of a sudden, it's all about doing things exactly as it's done. There will be no change. It hardens from the inside, and it seeks to only protect other members of the bureaucracy. One of the only things that the bureaucrats are able to do well is to weaponize against those who are a threat to the bureaucracy. When that happens, you will see it. There will be a ferocity. All of a sudden, an organization, an agency that can't seem to get very much of anything done, all of a sudden, it will act with a uniform and unilateral intent. It will move very quickly to squash those who are a problem for the organization. And so what you saw in this VA hospital, according to some in this Phoenix VA who were there, was people were afraid. And now, of course, there's a shame that's setting in, because now, as the truth has come out, as there were two lists, the fake list of we're giving people care and the real list, which was people waiting months and months, not for routine care, for life-saving care. This meant that veterans died. Based upon this report, dozens of them died because of the way that government functions and because of the tendency to always protect the system over the individuals that it is set up to serve. People inside didn't speak out. They thought it was more important to be able to put food on the table for their family or pay their mortgage or however they wanted to justify it in their minds. They allowed this. Some people, I'm not saying everybody in this hospital knew, I'm sure very few knew, but there were some in this VA chain of command who were aware of exactly what was going on here. They knew that those who had worn the uniform needed our help now. And that help was not forthcoming. It was delayed. And people perhaps, with an eye to promotion, with an eye to moving up the ladder, or just with an eye to keeping their job, decided that they weren't going to speak out and say anything. Well, what did that mean? For example, Teddy, this is, we're talking about one of the people in this piece, one of a family of one of the veterans, said that, Teddy said his Brooklyn-raised father was so proud of his military service that he would go nowhere but the VA for treatment. On September 28, 2013, with blood in his urine and a history of cancer, Teddy and his wife Sally rushed his father to the Phoenix VA emergency room, where he was examined and sent home to wait. They wrote on his chart that it was urgent, said Sally, her father-in-law's main caretaker. The family has obtained the chart from the VA that clearly states the urgency as 1 week, quote, 1 week, for Breen to see a primary care doctor, or at least a urologist. This is referring to Thomas Breen, who was a veteran who was seeking what he was owed by the VA, owed by the American people. The VA is just the vessel for the support, the care that's supposed to come from all of us through the VA. This is what our tax dollars are going towards. This is why there is a VA, to support veterans. So they wrote that there was an urgency of 1 week for Thomas Breen to see a primary care doctor, or at least a urologist, for the concerns about the blood in his urine. Now, I am not a doctor, but I can tell you that symptoms like blood in urine are to be taken, obviously, very seriously. He didn't show up with a tiny rash on his elbow. This was something worthy of immediate attention. They needed to shuffle the cards on the, or they needed to shuffle the deck, do what they had to do, in order to get this guy in to get seen. But they sent him home, said one of his family members incredulously. Now, Sally and Teddy, family members of Thomas Breen, say that Thomas was given an appointment with a rheumatologist to look at his prosthetic leg, but was given no appointment for the main reason he went in. And then, wait and wait and wait. No one called from the VA with a primary care appointment. Sally says she and her father-in-law called, quote, numerous times in an effort to try to get an urgent appointment for him. She says the response they got was less than helpful. Well, you know, we have other patients that are critical as well, Sally says she was told. It's a 7-month waiting list, and you're going to have patience. Sally says she kept calling day after day from late September to October. She kept up the calls through November, but then she no longer had reason to call. Thomas Breen, United States veteran, died on November 30th. The death certificate shows that he died from stage 4 bladder cancer. Months after that initial visit, after Thomas Breen died of bladder cancer that could have been detected based upon the symptom of the blood and the urine that the VA was not able to make a priority. Months after that initial visit, when they promised that he would be seen, Sally, from his family, says she finally did get a call. They called me December 6th. He's dead already. This is more than a scandal. This is an outrage. And it is something that we have to look at, not just in the context of this specific case, but how could this happen? And what does it mean for so many of the other discussions we are having right now about the obligations that we have to the state, what healthcare is going to look like, and whether government is really going to be this big, warm, fuzzy hug that protects and takes care of us, or a bureaucrat who says, get in line and wait and hope that you don't die. I'll be back in just a minute. We've got more on this.
You're listening to Buck Sexton, the Blaze Radio Network. Phone the Sexton Hotline. 888-900-3393.
I know that we've started out the show today on a pretty, as heavy really a topic as in some ways you can imagine, I would assume. And we've got a veteran who's dying because his government failed him. And I think that this is something we have to look at in the context of what does this mean when you've got the government in charge of not just care for veterans, which you would assume would be elevated even above and beyond what the average citizen might get. Because there is a special obligation here. What does it mean when the government's actually in charge of deciding what you get seen for and what you don't? What qualifies for coverage under your bronze or teal or whatever plan they're rolling out next? Their copper, tin plan, gold. So this is something we have to take very seriously, because when you think about what's coming for all of us, it's going to be worse than what's coming already for our veterans. And the more we learn about the VA, the backlog, and now some outright fraud, it seems, fraud that actually may have cost people their lives, then you have to start taking all of this stuff not just seriously, but deadly seriously. I'm actually joined now by Elizabeth Kreft. She is the intel and tech editor for TheBlaze.com. She's also a resident military expert. She served 12 years in the Air Force, both active duty and now in the Air National Guard. She's a major in the D.C. Air National Guard. Elizabeth, thank you for calling in.
Thanks, Buck. Thanks for bringing me on to talk about this.
Yeah, so let me just ask you, surprised by this? Expect this kind of thing to happen? More of this will come out? What do you think about this? I mean, this seems to be quite a bombshell that CNN has dropped here, and it's something that people should be really upset about, quite honestly.
Especially the news about the fraudulent list is shocking to any veteran who relies on this system for their care. But the problems, Buck, have been going on for years. Last year, I was a military advisor on Capitol Hill for a member from Arizona. And we had endless meetings with veterans organizations who continually said, this is a deadly issue. People are dying as they wait to get care. And not just, you know, these cancer screenings are incredibly important, and that's what has highlighted this issue in the last few months. But people were waiting for regular care as well, just to go get regular checkups, whether they had the flu or whatnot. And as you get older, obviously, these veterans who are relying on this system for that care, every issue is an urgent issue.
What is the main holdup? Is it just that this is a slow-moving, lethargic bureaucracy because it is run by the federal government, or is it a resource issue? Is it they don't have enough doctors? They don't have enough money? There's not enough being put towards this issue? I mean, how if let's just assume for a second, you know, where we were talking about Congress and what they can and can't do. If Congress was across the board willing to deal with this with seriousness and with urgency, What would they start to do? How do we fix this kind of a problem?
You know, you've started out by asking, what's the problem here? Is it really a resource problem, or is it just because it's managed by the government? I really think it's fair to say for the VA, it is both. It's primarily, though, an issue because it is a perfect example of socialized medicine. And I've joked about this with my military compatriots for years. You know, I grew up in the military healthcare system where all the adults in my life kind of joked and said, well, that's military healthcare for you. We can't get an appointment. We can't get in quickly enough. Now, it seems, especially after the last 11, 12 years of war, there has been a refocused emphasis getting more funding to the VA, especially for research for, let's say, PTSD patients. But the funding has not helped in a way of catching the VA up to the massive influx of people who are now going to rely on this system. You know, in November, Forbes reported that the VA just simply stopped reporting numbers on how many injuries were coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan. After they reached a milestone of 1 million injuries, they just stopped recording it. So it is twofold issue. It's the fact that the system is run by a bureaucratic, bloated government system, and also that I think the funding hasn't caught up to the issues.
Now, so is it fixable, I guess, then? Is it something that we're just going to have to live with? And also, you know, I think it's interesting that people have pointed to various forms of government health care as sort of to try to push Obamacare to say, look, you know, there's Medicare, there's Medicaid. Medicare is very popular, for example, because people don't have to pay for the care that they're getting. And they say, well, look at the veterans health care system. And that's been pointed to in the past as something that is actually on the side of government being in charge of more health care. Is this now going to start to change that conversation a little bit? It seems like if we can't provide a small segment of the population to which we have a special duty, i.e. veterans in this case, if we can't give them quality, I was about to say literally quality affordable health care, which is just how much the rot of Obamaism has spread into everyone's minds. But if we can't give them decent health care, how could we do that for the rest of the country?
That's the right question to ask, Buck. And, you know, especially when Obamacare was first introduced and the talk was, oh, there's going to be death panels, and doesn't this CNN story and doesn't this the story that's now come out about these reports from Phoenix and this doctor saying there's a sham list, I mean, doesn't that sound exactly like these massive fears that people have said, hey, we don't want other people deciding when I will be able to go in and see my doctor, and that's exactly what is being reported today. But, you know, another great example of this discussion is on April 9th, the chair of the VA was just lambasting some of these. They had a committee meeting on Veterans Affairs talking about this, and there was a specific gentleman from South Carolina who came in and said, look, I have stage 4 cancer. I already have my death sentence because the VA in my state would not give me the exams I needed on time. He begged for it. He finally was able to get himself examined and found out too late that he had stage 4 cancer. And he was able to come up to D.C. and at least give that testimony. So hopefully, if the congressional members, if our elected officials continue to discuss it at the very least, but, you know, Buck, you asked me what can be done. I guess it has to start with these hearings and calling out the Veterans Administration for these mistakes that have been made. But there is a lot of that standard back and forth talking where the lines are, well, we care about our veterans and every law.
But everyone pretends to care about the veterans, and then not everybody actually does anything about it. And I mean, specifically politicians, you know, they all bow down before veterans issues and act like there's so much respect from them about veterans. But really, a lot of them, it seems like, just sort of let the system continue on as is. I mean, how is more pressure brought to bear to fix this? Is that even possible politically?
I think where it comes down to, Buck, is when you actually see these numbers, when you're talking about specific delays and specific deaths. So these endoscopy screenings for the gastrointestinal cancer patients, when you're talking about 23 deaths or 40 deaths specifically drawn out and specifically identified to these sham lists or these long wait periods, that's when it's going to get really specific for these members of Congress. Because it's no longer just these big conversations where you can't really pinpoint where the inadequacies are. Now these families are gathering together and they're saying enough is enough.
Elizabeth, is this something that you might be working on for The Blaze, or can you give us a preview of what you are working on for this week?
Yeah, I have two calls in to members of Congress right now trying to get their quotes on this, trying to see how they're going to react to this news coming out of Arizona, especially with these sham lists, Buck. It's shocking news. Unfortunately, again, as I said, most of the VA people that I've already spoken with today have said it's not news to us.
Wow.
What I mean is the veterans' organizations.
That's really, really disheartening, but important for people to know. Guys, this is Elizabeth Kreft on the line. She is the intel and tech editor for TheBlaze.com. Follow her work there, especially on this issue. As she just said, she's following up on it. Elizabeth, thank you so much for calling in. Good to talk to you.
Thanks, Buck.
I'm sure some of you have opinions on this, and I want to hear them. 888-900-3393. Also, of course, on Twitter, at Buck Sexton, on Facebook, The Buck Sexton. We have some other guests. Second hour, we're going to do some national security. I'm also going to have to talk about, just for a few minutes, because I don't think there's too much to be said, but it has to be said, about this Bundy issue, which Glenn, fortunately, really laid out this morning. So I just have to echo some of those sentiments. We're not going to waste too much time on that, because it's already been said. Back in a minute.
You're listening to Buck Sexton, only on the Blaze Radio Network.
No doubt many of you have read the comments made by Nevada rancher Clive Bundy, and I'm sure many of you also heard Glenn talk about it in detail this morning on his radio show. I'm going to have a few words to say about that, but I also want to bring in any callers right now who want to talk about this Veterans Affairs issue before we move into Bundy. But if you know you want to say something about the Clive Bundy, it's now a debacle. If you want to say something about it, by all means, 888-900-3393. Get in the queue now. I have a feeling that some of you are going to have strong opinions about what must be said now. But let's first bring in Maya from Kansas on this issue of Veterans Affairs and Veterans Hospitals. Maya, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I worked as a healthcare counselor and tester from 2005 to 2012 because of the high number of people affected by viral hepatitis, in particular hepatitis C, which is a liver disease. A person can have this virus and it take over 10 years before it actually manifests any symptoms. So in other words, this is still called the silent killer by many people. For that reason, because by the time the symptoms manifest, you are pretty already sick, very sick. Now, the reality is hepatitis C is a virus that is largest among the military. Since the Vietnam War, and even before that, men were getting shot, getting their inoculations by way of a machine that would suggest that you were getting quickly vaccinated, but in reality, this machine, if you remember, these men would stand in line in their underwear, basically, and the doctor would come and shoot them with the same machine, hundreds, on and on and on. Well, they found out that hepatitis C was being transmitted.
Oh, my gosh.
Because even though you did not see the blood directly, the fact is, just pressing that into the skin caused blood to transfer back onto the gun. Now, the VA has denied this for a lot of years, many years. And Hep C organizations and the CDC have all talked about this. You can go on the web and check it out yourself. In any case, my services were being made available for civilians, because to a large extent, they were the ones who were not being talked to. The first year, I had something in the area of 32 military vets, okay, coming into my office trying to seek care from me because they were not able to get any from the VA hospital. Okay. The hospital documented the information when they were when they were diagnosed, and basically what they did was they told them to change their diet, which is a good thing to do, because the liver being the largest organ, you've got to cleanse it. You there are things you can do as far as eating, but they were not eager to try treatment. They were not eager to do anything that would require them admittance into the hospital, because usually treatment was anywhere from 7 to 10 months long.
Okay. So they were trying to avoid treating these veterans for this disease.
Yeah, because it cost
because of cost issues.
Yeah, and not to mention the fact many of the vets that were coming were homeless themselves.
I mean, this is amazing. Okay. You know, we lose $80 billion a year to Medicare fraud. One would think that we could find the federal government with its printing presses could maybe find the money in the federal couch cushion somewhere to actually pay for treatment for veterans who need it. So Maya, this is basically what I'm getting from you is that this is not a new thing, and this is not surprising either.
No, it's not. As a matter of fact, it's the most pathetic thing I've ever heard. I mean, I come from a family of military. My father just passed away last year. And, you know, they gave him the respect that was due him. But it seems to me that we're going the way of the only thing that anyone's willing to guarantee right now is you coming into the world and you exiting it. And that's probably not going to be true after a while. But please, you know, you might be hearing from other vets because of my call. They will tell you that this is true, and you can check out on the web. I talked about it. I was on radio. I was on TV. I was everywhere, and I was not silenced, but I wasn't really paid attention to.
All right. Well, you've been paid attention to here, Maya. Thank you for telling everybody about what you know to be the case with the Veterans Administration and how it's dealing with veterans, supposed to be getting them health care. And to think that the government is now essentially in charge of 1/6 of the economy and really is calling all the shots in healthcare. Just give it time. It's all going to be determined by bureaucrats, and we're not going to have the moral position of saying, oh, well, you know, at least this is what we get in return for service. No, those bureaucrats, because we're not all veterans, they're going to be able to look at us and say, yeah, you know, you're lucky to get whatever you get. Let's take Ralph in Arizona, whom I see here has been going to the very Phoenix VA we're talking about. Ralph, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Buck. Let me first start saying I love your show. I've listened to it ever since it came on. And, yeah, I'm a veteran. I moved from Texas over to Arizona here about 3 years now because the Big Springs VA system was so poor. I fought for 2 months to try to get a tooth pulled. So I came over. I have a friend over here in Mesa. I came over here and I started going here. When I first got here, it was not bad, about the same. But then all of a sudden, a whole lot of doctors left. And it's now, if you want to get an appointment, it's a year.
A year?
A year off.
Wow.
To get an appointment to see your doctor, just to, you know, let them check your heart, look at your ear, down your throat. Whatever. But when you do get treatment at the VA, it is excellent care. I have to say that. It is excellent care. And there's some reasons for that. I've talked to doctors, dentists in Brecksville, Ohio. A lot of the appointments got pushed back because of the war. Iraq, Afghanistan, they pulled doctors out of the VA to go over there and help our soldiers.
So do you think that this issue is going to get is going to maybe not be quite as bad as there's the drawdown from U.S. troops in theater? Is that, I mean, we've already drawn down in Iraq.
Well,
we're drawing down Afghanistan. Is that going to be a part of it, or is that not nearly enough?
Well, a lot of the doctors are coming back, but are they going to come back to work for the VA or not? Because I had one of the doctors I was seeing for PTSD. She left, and I didn't keep my other appointment. I missed that. So now they tell me it's an 8-month wait just to get in, and I can't even get medicine. I can't even get my medicines because I have to see the doctor. before they can give me my medicine.
So they won't give you the prescriptions needed to help treat your PTSD until you can get the doctor's appointment, which you can't get for a year.
You need a doctor. Yeah, right.
And I keep saying this, Ralph. You're a veteran. This is supposed to be an elevated status in terms of the way the government is going about treatment here. This is a sacred obligation. This is not. I know I shouldn't put it this way, but this is not Medicaid. This isn't the government doing you a favor. This is the government doing what it needs to do to uphold its end of the bargain. And I am just, if this could exist. If this could exist at the VA, what do people think it's going to be like when essentially all hospitals have consolidated under the Obamacare regime and are trying to cut costs?
They've been talking about Obamacare. There's going to be a doctor shortage. You're going to start seeing this, longer wait times at regular doctor's offices.
Of course. Well, that's absolutely baked into the cake at this point. There's plenty of—go ahead.
I don't know if you're old enough. Back in the early 80s, maybe late 70s.
I was born in 81, so there you go.
I got out in 73 out of the Army, and I went back to my home in Akron, but I was going to the Cleveland VA, and they had a soldier die at Cleveland. They left him. Nobody would go back and look at him. The nurses wouldn't see him. The doctors wouldn't see him for 3 days. And Senator Metzenbaum was our senator. You could probably look it up, but he actually... It's hard to fire people in the VA system. It actually took a senator to come up and roll heads.
Well, it's hard to fire somebody in any federal job, unless they blow the whistle on Democrats. Then they might be toast. But short of that, they're not getting fired.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Ralph, I mean, it's good to hear from somebody who. Well, first of all, thank you for your service, and it's good for us to hear from somebody who actually has been to not just the VA, but this specific Phoenix VA. That this report on CNN is dealing with and pointing out this malfeasance. But Ralph, thank you very much for your call. Let's take one more. This is one of the amazing things about getting to do this show, as I've said many times, and I refer with tremendous affection and respect to Team Buck. But as you know from listening to the show, Team Buck not only includes patriots and scientists and teachers and lawyers and people from all walks of life. We have a very strong military contingent that listens to this show. I even get emails from people who are downrange saying, hey, man, love the Buck Brief. Keep it up. Keep doing it. And that's probably the biggest honor that I've had yet in this whole media world that I've been working in for a while. And that's hearing from guys who are downrange saying they appreciate what we're doing here, you and me talking about day after day on this show. But with that said, let me take one more call before we go into a break here. Let's take Phil from Indiana, another veteran calling in to share his thoughts. Phil, you're on the Buck Sexton Show.
Well, hello, Buck, and excellent job filling in for Rush yesterday. I appreciate everything you've done, and you're an excellent patriot yourself. Well,
thank you very much, sir, and thank you for your service.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Basically, I've been a disabled in-service vet since 93. I took a fall while I was serving in the Navy. And I'm still trying to get my condition fully evaluated 21 years later. The VA is short on doctors. They can't seem to keep anybody. The care there is excellent once you get it. Unfortunately, everything else seems to be more important than the vet.
Right. So this is you're echoing, it sounds like, the sentiments of some of the other veterans or people who have worked with veterans who have called in, which is just that if you can get in the door, what happens is pretty good, actually. The doctors are good. The treatment is good. But it's a question of the queue, the line. It's, if this was the Soviet Union, it's not that you're waiting in the bread line and you get in the store and there's no bread. There's actually food in there, but you've got a long line to get in and you can wait too long in that line. Is that a fair analogy as to how it seems to be working?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I've been waiting to get my appeals and claim heard and administered since 2007. They told me I'm halfway through the queue, which means I'm about 3.5 years out before they'll ever even get to me.
I don't even know how you've I understand that you have no option here, but I mean, the patience that you've had to show, and I'm sure the frustration that is attendant to this whole thing is just, it's mind-boggling. And the more we hear about this, how could this be? How are we, if we can't provide medical services that are owed to veterans by their government for their service. How can this Obama regime, how can the federal government even pretend that they should be more? If they can't handle this, how are they going to handle everybody else? I can't help but transition in my mind to not only is this an outrage because of what it means for veterans who have to wait and wait and as we just heard, some die waiting. But on top of that, now they just are so lacking in being introspective and looking at their capabilities and what they can do as a government that they want to do more of it. They want to be more in charge. They want to be in charge of the lines, the queues for everyone to get care, essentially, under this behind this fig leaf of it being a free market. I mean, Phil, what faith do you have in the government getting you health care?
Well, I have not a whole lot of faith, actually, but the OAS movement's going to Washington on the 16th of May to particularly address all this overreach.
Please, what's that movement again?
It's the OAS, which is Operation American Spring. It's an organization that was started by a Colonel Riley, who is retired from the Army. And we're hoping to get 10 million to show up with a million to stay for as long as it takes.
Well, and the end goal of this is?
The angle of this is to get the government to recognize that the people are in charge, and we the people want our Constitution to be adhered to, just as our founding fathers intended it to be.
All right. Well, Phil, best of luck, and thank you very much for your service, and thank you for calling in and sharing your perspective. 888-900-3393. I got one more topic that's not going to – it's not fun to talk about, but we need to talk about it. And then I promise you, second hour, national security. We'll do some lighter stuff. You know, I know it's lunch break for a lot of you guys. We're gonna spruce it up a bit, but one more thing we got to talk about in just a minute.
Let your voice be heard.
Hello.
888-900-3393.
Buck Sexton Show.
On the Blaze Radio Network.
Buck Sexton.
888-900-3393 is the call-in. We have talked here on this show a couple of times at least about the cattle battle, as it was called in the media, the standoff between the Bureau of Land Management and Nevada rancher Clive Bundy. And when we've talked about it and when I've tried to approach this issue, I have a proclivity. I have a general inclination to want to see the federal government curtailed in some capacity within the limits established by the Constitution and with respect to federal statutes in every case possible and permissible. And that's what I'd like to see. I think that federal overreach is threatening to strangle our freedom. I really see it happening day in and day out, and it is an evil that has to be confronted. Now, with all of that said, this was a complicated issue when you talk about the background and history of this grazing right, and I'm not a rancher. There are some things I can talk to you about, and even at my 32 years on this earth, have some direct and personal experience. When I talk to you about Afghanistan, it's not because I've read about it in books. When I talk to you about the insurgency in Iraq or counterterrorism operations, even in other places that I can't talk to you about specifically, that's because I've done them. I know them. I have a feeling for them from experience. Ranching is outside my wheelhouse, so I've had to be clear about that from the beginning. But what's not outside of my wheelhouse is calling out just unbelievable ignorance and stupidity. And I'm sure some of you have seen it, and if you haven't, or if you didn't hear Glenn on it this morning, Clive and Bundy decided to speak to the New York Times and say some things that are flatly indefensible, to use language that's flatly indefensible and to make it such that it's essentially impossible now for certainly any politician, any public figure, any public analyst to even try to refocus the discussion on this issue of individuals versus the federal government. I can't even read to you, really, or I am uncomfortable reading to you the direct quotes from Mr. Bundy in this context, because they could be used out of context, and I will have said things on air that I am not comfortable saying, that are inappropriate for me to say. I don't know how much more needs to be said about this other than the comments as written in the New York Times are, and I'm somebody who does not like, I don't bow to political correctness. I don't care what the media says about a lot of things. This is not that. He stepped in it. He really showed a side that I don't think anybody can ignore. And he should have been aware of the fact that he's speaking to the New York Times. These comments are going to get out there, and they are offensive. And we have to call them out for what they are, unacceptable. And if he believed that he was starting a movement, and I know I might get some angry emails and such about this, because there are some out there who seem to not care. I don't care. Send me the angry emails. What this guy said can't be defended. What this guy said is deplorable. And just goes to show you that somebody can take a stand on a certain issue, and you can say, well, that issue, I can see sort of where he's going, but people will let you down. And if anyone really put a lot of hope and stock in Bundy as somebody who could be a rallying cry for individual freedom versus the federal government, all of that's gone now. All that's left is somebody who made some just really repugnant comments on race. I don't know what else can be said about it other than that. And now, just wait, anybody who thought that they were involved in a discussion about the federal government and overreach and such, now they all probably get tarred with the same brush. They all get pushed around with the same, pushed around with the same attacks. Because anyone who was too close to this issue is now going to get lit up by the media that, look, MSNBC and some of these other channels, they say things are racist when they're not even vaguely racist. Well, this is not that. This is actually a problem, what was said. This is actually racially unacceptable language and commentary. And it just puts anybody who was standing alongside Bundy in this context in the worst possible light. And it's just deplorable, and it's deeply disappointing. It's disappointing that anybody would say this in any context. Forget about whether this guy is somebody that should have been rallied around or what have you. And I was always, and now, of course, everyone's going to say, I was always skeptical, but it's just a shame. It really is such to see somebody. It's a shame at so many levels. It's a shame that somebody would even say this in this day and age. And to use this kind of language and to muse about these things publicly. I don't know. That's all I've got on this. It's just, wow, bad, very bad. Murdoch from South Carolina, you want to talk about veterans issues, and I would much rather talk about that than this. Murdoch, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I was just calling. I've been hearing a lot about the treatment. Once you do get into the VA appointment, that the treatment's been good, and I can say, from my experience, I was crushed by a MH-53 helicopter. I've had 17 surgeries in the last 7 years, and I have fought with the VA because in the Cleveland VA hospital, the 90% of the doctors that are in there are training doctors. And I've had 6 extra surgeries because they've made mistakes. And my wife and I, we have both been into the patient advocate, and we were specifically told that because we were veterans and we got the medical care, we had no choice in what doctor could look after us, that we got basically whatever doctor was available.
Is there anybody, Murdoch, who can be an advocate for you in this process? Or we only have a minute left, by the way. I would give you more time, but the machine literally cuts me off here. But just give me 30 seconds on who can help. Who do you want to help? Who could actually do something to help you here? Murdoch? Did we lose him? Oh, it looks like, I'm sorry, guys. I wanted to hear what Murdoch had to say, but we just lost the call somehow. All right. You know, thank you for staying with me. This hour, we've dealt with some tough stuff, stuff that we have to talk about, though. Next hour, national security. We're going to war game some stuff out with Ukraine. Going to talk to you about the latest Benghazi report. We have a special guest who's going to join us on that to tell us that apparently Benghazi was a long time in coming, and as a result of some serious missteps by the U.S. federal government. And then later on in the hour, I don't know, I got to have some fun. We got to lighten it up around here. I don't want it to be all super intense and crazy all day. This is Buck Sexton live from the Freedom Hut. Really enjoying the time that I'm spending with you guys, as always. Back in just a few minutes, 888-900-3393.
Buck Sexton.
On the Blaze Radio Network.
Now, spreading freedom across the nation, this is 3, 2, 1.
The Buck Sexton Show.
What if the Benghazi attack could have been prevented? Meaning that what if there were not only signs of an impending strike on U.S. facilities in Benghazi, but also there was a decision made at the strategic level, very high up the food chain in terms of U.S. national security bureaucracy, that had direct impact and therefore put us on a straight line trajectory to having al-Qaeda as a major component of the anti-Qaddafi resistance, and on top of that then, of course, leading to a revenge strike against the U.S. And two U.S. facilities, killing four Americans in Benghazi. Well, that's what's raised in a recent report from the Citizens Committee on Benghazi. Before we get into that, I think it's time we switch gears with a Buck Brief.
You are entering the Blaze Threat Ops Center. This is a secure space. All outside comms are down. Prepare to receive the Buck Brief.
So this is from the Daily Mail. The bullet points on this recent report: Citizens Committee on Benghazi claims the U.S. government allowed arms to flow to al-Qaeda-linked militants who opposed Muammar Gaddafi. Their rise to power, the group says, led to the Benghazi attack in 2012. The group claims the strongman Gaddafi offered to abdicate his presidency, but the U.S. refused to broker his peaceful exit. The commission, part of the center-right Accuracy in Media Group, concluded that the Benghazi attack was a failed kidnapping plot. And they also said that U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens was to be captured and traded for blind Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman, who hatched the 1993 World Trade Center bombing plot. Now, what is the Citizens Commission on Benghazi? It is a group of former military officers, CIA officers, and think tankers. And I believe we're going to have one of them joining us in just a few minutes here to tell us about this report. Now, I haven't seen the report, so I can't comment specifically on its contents, although I believe we will have somebody joining us shortly who can do exactly that. But what I can tell you is that Libya right now is a country that is not appearing very much in the news, because it is, largely speaking, a disaster. Over the summer, the oil terminals were shut down. The prime minister was seized by gunmen out of a hotel in Tripoli, eventually released, but gives you a sense of what kind of security we're talking about here. Libya really is a sort of fictional country in terms of the boundaries. Most of the oil terminals, which is almost all of the country's actual revenue, are in this sort of central and eastern portion of Libya, and really the country's broken down into two. There's two main cities to represent its eastern and western halves. You have Tripoli and you have Benghazi. Benghazi in the east, which has always been known as more of a hotbed of extremism. There's been a jihadist presence there stretching back for over a decade at this point. In fact, Derna is well known as one of the primary transit points for foreign fighters into the conflict in Iraq and now into Syria as well. Derna is where you want to go. If you want to get your jihad on, if you want to show up in Syria now and strap on a suicide vest or just take some shots with an AK at Assad and anybody else that you decide needs to feel the brunt of your jihadist rage, which unfortunately also includes the Christian population of Syria, which is evaporating, or I shouldn't say evaporating, it's being forced to disappear, it's being cleansed, it's being annihilated in bits and pieces, just as it was largely in Iraq before that. Christianity is disappearing from the Middle East without so much as a peep from the Western powers. We don't seem to notice or care, perhaps both. But Libya is now deciding that it's going to have to tackle its violent extremism. Now, this is from Reuters today. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State William Burns promised today to give Libya more U.S. help against extremist violence, saying the country could not achieve political or economic stability without tackling its security challenges. Libya's weak central government is struggling to assert its authority against militias and armed tribesmen who helped oust Muammar Gaddafi in a 2011 NATO-backed uprising. Rising violent extremism is an enormous challenge, first for Libya, but also for Libya's international partners, Burns told a news conference after talks in the capital of Tripoli. That's why we have such a sense of urgency and such a sense of determination to help Libyans build their own security capacity, to deepen counterterrorism cooperation, and also to promote the kind of healthy political process that increases the chances of greater security over the long term. Now, Burns is the most senior U.S. official to visit this country since the Islamist militant attack, jihadist terrorist attack, that happened in Benghazi in September of 2012. So they're finally sending, just today, they've sent somebody over there. Now, why would they be doing that now? Let's just try to go beneath the headlines together a little bit. Do you think there could be some connection to the fact that now this report has come out that says that Libya was not just a problem of that Benghazi was not just a problem of the fog of war and tactical issues and security concerns and considerations and snafus and things happen? What if Libya was an instance of the U.S. government getting it entirely wrong, backing Assad here? Maybe that's why we've been so gun-shy with respect to Syria, with backing the rebels there. Maybe some of the voices that have been calling for more action in Syria aren't aware, and I mean action by assisting anti-Assad forces, by helping Jabhat al-Nusra in the process. That's going to be an issue, isn't it? If you're helping an al-Qaeda-aligned militant group in order to get rid of Assad, we don't like Assad. Assad's bad, not our puppet, more of our hobgoblin, but Assad was stable. Assad didn't keep the Israelis on edge the way that a jihadist, not just regime, that probably won't happen. Assad looks like he's going to hang on, but a jihadist safe haven in Syrian territory would. There's nothing that the Israelis can do to placate forces like al-Qaeda in Iraq and Sham, Jabhat al-Nusra, and all the rest. It's literally not possible for them to find a means to work with them. And while there's a lot of animosity, obviously, from Assad towards the Israelis, it was a stable regime, autocratic, dictatorial, vicious, brutal, thuggish, absolutely all of those things. But in Libya, the administration, the Obama administration, under R2P, responsibility to protect, a doctrine, by the way, upon which people like Susan Rice, the it was a video lady, who's currently national security advisor, ambassador, former ambassador to the UN, Susan Rice, and current ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, they built their careers on this R2P doctrine. It has a cute acronym and everything. The idea being that the United States, because we are the global hegemon, you know, they think we've made a lot of mistakes, but we have an obligation to protect populations that are vulnerable. Well, in Syria, obviously, we don't care at all. They're using chemical weapons now that are just old school chemical weapons. There are reports about using chlorine bombs, which, by the way, for any of you who served in Iraq will probably recall Al-Qaeda, particularly in Anbar province in western Iraq during the worst parts of the insurgency, 2006, 2007, and into 2008, used chlorine bombs as well. So the notion that John Kerry brokered this deal and everything's going to be fine now because they got rid of their chemical weapons, well, now they're just going old school with their horrific chemical weapons attacks. And, of course, well, which side is responsible for it? I mean, the point is it's a meat grinder, and over 150,000 people have been killed. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands more have been wounded grievously, either physically or psychologically, for all time. This is a country that's essentially going up in flames, and we've done, the administration does nothing. Well, what's interesting is that we were willing to do something in Libya, but what did that lead us to? How well did we know those anti-Gaddafi fighters who just happened to come from the same towns that were the primary launch pad for suicide bombers to show up in Iraq and, yes, blow up checkpoints that were manned by our soldiers? We lost people. We lost our men in uniform because of exactly that pipeline from Derna, from Benghazi, from the eastern portion of Libya, Barqa, as the province is known. They went right in to Iraq, and now they're going right into Syria. But the Obama administration seemed willing to come down on their side. Well, could Benghazi have been prevented? And what actually does that tell us about what the administration did with its leading from behind NATO intervention in this country that currently is becoming a safe haven for global jihadists? We're going to be joined by Wayne Simmons in just a minute to answer that question. He is of the Citizens Committee on Benghazi. He's going to tell us everything that's in that report that he can in just a minute.
Buck Sexton, The Blaze Radio Network.
Joined now by Wayne Simmons. He is of the Citizens Commission on Benghazi and a former government officer as well, right, Wayne? You're part of the Brotherhood, as I understand it.
Roger that. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you very much for calling in. I have to give you the floor, sir, because I have not read this report, so you have to familiarize us with its contents a little bit, and then let's talk about what it means. So what is this Citizens Commission on Benghazi? What did it find? I mean, sorry, not what is it? What did the report that the commission put out find about the Benghazi debacle?
Well, and look, the Citizens Commission on Benghazi, as you may or may not know, is comprised of a whole lot of admirals, a whole lot of brass, a lot of flag officers, some guys from where you and I come from, and gals, I might add. And what we decided a year ago was that we knew. And no matter what, after listening to the government, to Hillary Clinton and her cronies, including Obama, that there was never going to be a definitive, truthful resolution to what happened in Benghazi the night we lost an ambassador and, of course, our three warfighters. So what we did was, over the last 7 months, 8 months, we have used our considerable access to information, which, as you do, we still have all of our assets. We have access to those assets, and both active and non-active. And what we've come up with, in a nutshell, is that Hillary Clinton, the State Department, and Barack Obama, and excuse me, let me back up 1 second and make one thing absolutely perfectly clear. What I'm saying to you is not conjecture. It is not hyperbole. It is fact. In the report, when your listeners and others get to take a look at the report and read the report, you will see that this is backed up by documentation from boots on the ground, from folks who actually saw this. And we did the yeoman's work to assemble all of this. So what we know is, for the lack of, since we have some limited time here, is basically that we all would agree that Gaddafi was our bad guy. We would all agree he is one of the worst humans on
the
planet.
He was an SOB, but he was our SOB, right?
He was our SOB, and that's exactly right. And we, you know, we had recently in Bush entered into another agreement with him back in 2006. So he was our guy. Most importantly, he detested the Al-Qaeda and any other terrorist groups. He had to be the guy that controlled his country. Great. What happened is Al-Qaeda and all of the other terrorist groups from all over the region, from as far away as Afghanistan, came back in. They formed their Al-Qaeda groups. And, of course, we had the uprising in Libya. The moment that the Libyan uprising started, of course, what's not known to most folks is that Muammar Gaddafi saw the handwriting on the wall and actually made an overture to the White House to abdicate, to leave. He wanted nothing to do with this. He agreed to leave. We, again, in the report, we will show you and back up all of this. So he's signaled to us. Admiral Chuck Chubik was one of the main arbiters in this and helped arrange this. Chuck, as you know, Admiral Chubik, as you know, is part of the commission.
Can I just ask, Wayne, so he was going to take the Saddam deal, which we offered Saddam at one point, which was, look, if you step down, you move away, we'll work, you know, we'll essentially let you, we'll let you go, we'll let you live. Is that kind of what happened?
Well, we're going to let you live, but we're also, he wanted some stuff for his family. It's the regular stuff. It's, look, just to let us keep some of our money, and we're going to get out of the way. What happens is, when we think that that's done, Hillary Clinton and Barack Hussein Obama kill that deal. It came, we know that, because General Hamm was right in the middle of this, agreed to the deal, and said yes. He reached out, and you and I both know when a flag officer reaches out to somebody, it's got to be somebody like Hillary Clinton or the White House.
Right.
They nixed the deal. So the long and the short of it is we ended up arming with $500 million. When I say we, Hillary Clinton's State Department ends up arming Al-Qaeda, our enemies, same guys who have been killing Americans in Afghanistan and came over here and killed 3,000 of us. She ends up knowingly arming Al-Qaeda with $500 million worth of arms.
Where do these arms come from?
We supplied them. We were supplying them. We were supplying the weapons. They were supposed to be going to Muammar through UAE. And what happened was when Gaddafi stepped down, our folks, meaning UAE, actually went over to collect their $1 billion. So when they went over to collect the $1 billion, they were informed, and again, all backed up by documentation, they were informed that there was only a half a billion because the rest of it went to the rebels. So in other words, UAE travels to Libya to collect their payment from the weapons that they financed. And Qatar delivered this to the Transitional National Council during the war. So now UAE is looking for their billion because they're owed a billion. So they go to Tripoli. That's when UAE discovers that $1 billion worth of weapons is no longer $1 billion, but rather $500 million.
Now, this is the question that immediately jumps into my mind. Why would, from what you could gather, why did Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton decide to nix the deal, the Gaddafi step down deal? Was it because they wanted to make an example of him? Do they want a foreign policy victory for their administration? And what was the what's the impetus behind that?
Listen, those are all great questions. And that is, those are, I don't want to say the $64,000 question. There are so many, there are a plethora of reasons that, that the administration wanted to support this, because when we look back, we of course struggle with the Syrian issue. What we find is that we have a concerted effort on the part of the Obama administration to continue to lend support to the Muslim Brotherhood. They continue to lend support to Al-Qaeda and to the rebels. So we have this sweeping North Africa of Hillary Clinton and her group that are disarming our our assets. And we just cannot, quite frankly, figure out what it is that is motivating the Obama administration to do that. All we do know is that it has happened. And believe me, the Gaddafi's ministers of interior, you know, they found out that these weapons were sold to Al-Qaeda. They protested, and of course, they didn't last long. You know, General Yunus was killed in 2011 after he decided that that should not have happened.
So
there's so many key significant keys in this demonstration of the chain of command between the Muslim Brotherhood and Ansar al-Sharia. And Buck, this just goes on. You have to have a grease board like we did, or the report in front of you with a marker to keep track of all the players.
Now, the arms you're talking about are being sold to fighters in Libya, which are obviously infiltrated by jihadists and al-Qaeda and such. But what about the transfer of arms from Libya to Syria via Turkey and Lebanon? Is that stuff that you guys were able to, did you come across documentation? Do you have sources that can confirm that? That's always been part of this narrative, that there was an effort to use, because look, it's sort of like if you want to give Syrians weapons that don't necessarily trace back to the U.S., where do you go? Well, Gaddafi had some big, dusty stockpiles of AKs and RPGs and all the rest. That's great stuff if you want to hand it over to the Syrian rebels without openly doing it. Did you come across that? Was that happening? Do you believe that was happening?
No, listen, we did not. Do we believe that it was happening? Yes. What we stayed, and I'm sure you understand this, it is so easy with this type of an intel op to get sidetracked, and we tried to stay so very, very focused on exactly what took place with the war in Libya. And you know, people don't understand, as bad as this guy was, meaning Gaddafi, he really was one of our only allies in this global war on terror. He was the guy that he was not going to give up his country under any circumstance. So your question, which was a very good question, a very pointed and direct, as it should be, what motivated Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama to make these moves? We just have not been able to get to understand that with any definitive clarity.
Well, I have one more thing I've got to get to with you, Wayne, here, yeah, before the, as I call it, the Soros machine cuts me off. And that is that the part of the report states that U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens was to be captured and traded for Omar Abdelrahman, the blind sheikh involved in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing plot. Yes. Take us through that, because I'll be honest with you, that's the part of this where I started to go, I've heard this before, and it seems like quite a stretch to me, but try to make a believer of me if you would, sir.
Okay, that's a great question. Look, and I don't think, just so you're clear, we're not trying to convince anyone of any of this with regards to that kidnapping. Four-star Admiral Ace Lyons, who we all know, one of the most respected men in the history of the United States military and the Navy, truly believes that that could have been one of the reasons that the op went sideways. Andy McCarthy, I think, as you know, a friend who was the U.S. attorney, assistant U.S. attorney.
He's a friend of the show. We know Andy. Go ahead.
Yeah, Andy is a great guy. And so we've had those discussions with him. None of us have any definitive proof. That is something that Admiral Lyons believes may have been the genesis of this. But I think that what on my side, what I have tried to do is just give everyone an insight into exactly what these war fighters were going through when it was happening. We know that they could have been saved. We know that we had aerial assets in Sigonella, no question. And we have, and I'll leave this with you quickly, we know that in order for these weapons to have been transferred over as they were, and we have documents to prove, it takes a minimum of five federal agencies to approve that. Five.
All right. The Citizens Commission on Benghazi. Wayne, where can people go to read the report?
I would go to, you can, of course, look it up, Citizens Commission on Benghazi on Google, or go to accuracyandmedia.org.
Accuracyandmedia.org, Citizens Commission on Benghazi. Wayne Simmons, thank you very much for your time, my friend. Always good to hear from somebody from the community. Guys, we're back in a minute on Ukraine.
You're listening to Buck Sexton, only on the Blaze Radio Network. Sexton Show, 888-900-3393.
Lines are open. You just heard the number, 888-900-3393. And we'll take, before we go on to the latest in Ukraine, a call from Shelley in Colorado, who has been waiting for quite a while. Shelley, you are on the Buck Sexton Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, Buck. Long-time listener since last year.
That's as long as it can be, so thank you.
Yeah, but first-time caller.
Thank you.
And you were great on the Rush Limbaugh program the last two times you spoke.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Yeah. But hey, as far, and I know you're going a different direction, I'll be short. I know the Bundy situation. The only thing I want to say about that is I find it really strange that this was supposedly said at a press conference, but there was only one reporter, one photographer, and nobody got an audio of him saying this, because if there was audio, I think the New York Times would be one of the first people to put out the audio, don't you?
Well, Shelley, let me say this. I understand, look, any reporting, especially from an agenda-driven outlet like the New York Times, you want to take with some degree of skepticism. But as far as I know, and I could be wrong, no member of the Bundy family or Clive himself has come out and said that these are not that they didn't say this. And so with that being the case, I think there has to be, it's a pretty fair assumption. Look, if somebody said this about anybody, right, if somebody falsified these kinds of statements, you would be completely outraged, because you would recognize, any intelligent person would realize, that their reputation is now effectively destroyed. And if the Bundys think that, if this is a lie, essentially, which I believe is what you're saying, this, it seems strange to you, it's fishy, it seems like maybe this was fabricated, or at least taken and created in some sort of strange contextual way, I would assume the Bundys would come out and say that this is not what was said, or this is an outrage. Because they haven't done that, Shelley, don't you think it's fair to think that this was probably said, maybe?
Well, that is a fair point as well.
And now they could come out tomorrow or later today. I mean, I'm just saying, so
right.
Far we have to assume it's true, and if it's true, it's right. Really bad.
Well, and if this was him speaking offhand to some passerby or something, then, you know, maybe it's not unusual that there's no audio. But the way the Times set it up is that it was a press conference, and there were lots of supporters there. And I guess I would have thought maybe even some supporters / infiltrators, you know, somebody there to rile somebody up, would have a recording of it.
Well, I will.
And I guess until I see that, I'm going to reserve judgment.
All right, Shelley. Well, first of all, I thank you for listening to my show, supporting my show, and I will keep an eye out for anything that leads me to believe that this was not what happened, but I think it is what happened, and I think that this means that the whole Bundy situation has to be looked at in a very different light. There's no way around it. It's just, you can't say the stuff that guy said. Unacceptable. So let's put the Bundy thing aside. Let's go back to the Ukraine. Not the Ukraine, Ukraine. I will say that very early on, I was somebody who pointed out, because I have a Ukrainian friend, and she said, it's not the Ukraine, it's Ukraine. And I've been saying that. And some media outlets were initially calling it the Ukraine. But now everybody's gotten on board with this whole Ukraine thing. No unnecessary article there. But things are not going well, to put it mildly. Putin, this is from Business Insider, is warning of consequences with Ukraine's, quote, anti-terror operation in full swing. Now, I've said before, it's really not an anti-terror operation. It's almost more of a counterinsurgency operation, because what's going on here is a subversion from within, or at least subversion with the hand of the Russian state behind it. But they're trying to subvert the state. They're not just trying to terror would be more of an attack meant to instill fear. They're actually trying to create a false legitimacy for a secession movement, which is a I know these are nuances, but they're important nuances. They're distinctions here. And I think that calling it a counterterror operation in some sense, because it's not directly accurate for the Ukrainian state to say that, is in some sense counterproductive. They should really be calling it a counterinsurgency operation. That's just my take on it. But Vladimir Putin doesn't really care what they're calling it, because he is not okay with it. He has said that the deployment of the army in eastern Ukraine by the Kiev authorities constitutes a, quote, serious crime against their own people and will have consequences. Now, we said this on April 24th, as Ukrainian authorities announced that they've had some success in their military operation to dislodge pro-Russia insurgents in the east. And the Ukrainian Interior Minister said that the anti-terrorist operations in Slovyansk region of Donetsk, these are fun words to say, had destroyed 3 illegal armed checkpoints and killed 5 terrorists, and 1 Ukrainian counterterrorism troop was reportedly wounded. This is all on Business Insider right now. Meanwhile, Ukraine is stepping up its military offensive in these eastern towns. And we have this situation where the Russian government has decided to come out and say that an attack on anyone who is Russian, attack on Russian citizens, is an attack on the Federation. And that means that there will be really severe military action taken as a result of such a provocation. Now, this is a very tense situation. You're continuing to see this sort of standoff play out. And President Obama is in Asia this week. He is talking to the countries, most notably South Korea, the Philippines, and Japan, talking to these countries about when he was in Japan, of course, because he went to the Jiro Dreams of Sushi restaurant. It's a documentary. It's actually a very good, very pleasant documentary. Most documentaries these days have just such, they're essentially long form progressive screeds. They've become an editorial tool of the left. They claim it's a documentary because, you know, they're documenting reality. But in fact, they're pushing a very clear agenda. The best example of this I can think of off the top of my head is An Inconvenient Truth, although there are many, many others, Fahrenheit 9/11. Documentary as an art form, or as a form of film, has essentially been taken over by the progressive left. And there's very little that we do to push back against this. There have been some attempts, most notably, I think, recently Dinesh D'Souza's Obama 2016. But in fact, what we see here, Jiro Dreams of Sushi, sorry. Guys, you know I digress. Jiro Dreams, it's actually good. It's about making the perfect sushi. I love sushi. Check it out. It's a good movie. Obama went to that restaurant, though, apparently didn't eat all of his sushi, which is unsurprising, because as I said yesterday on Rush's show, you know, Obama's a better sushi chef than his sushi chefs, just as he's a better writer for speeches than his speech writers, policy director than his policy directors, better at sushi making, too. But what's going to happen in Ukraine? What's coming down the pike in this situation? Just a week ago, people were writing breathless headlines about the start of World War III. Well, Obama's telling the Japanese that we'll go to war over the Senkaku Islands if need be, because we promised Japan we've got their back. I think that Putin declaring that he will invade Ukraine has much more resonance now on the world stage than Obama saying that we'll back up Japan, we'll back up anybody. And this has a destabilizing effect on a whole lot of things. I'm going to bring in my friend Stephen Yates of DC International Advisors in just a minute to give his take on Ukraine. The deep dive on national security continues, Team Buck. Don't go anywhere.
Taking intelligence to a whole new level. Buck Sexton.
The Blaze Radio Network.
Buck Sexton.
Just as a follow-on to the caller who asked about whether or expressed some skepticism before on the Bundy remarks, I'm seeing here on Mediaite, Clive Bundy's already come out and said, yeah, I said it, and then tried to explain it more. I don't think that there's any further for him to dig, but if that were possible, he's digging even deeper. This is the cause. He has collapsed his cause, if he ever had one, really, with racist remarks. It's all over. Done. Can't be resurrected. Can't say anything about it. He has come out and said that he said it. He should not have said it. It's unacceptable what he said. And now that's all that can be said about it. It's really disgusting. All right, back to Ukraine. Stephen Yates is calling in. He is, of course, the former Deputy National Security Advisor from Vice President Dick Cheney's office. He's also the CEO of DC International Advisors and a candidate for office in the state of Idaho, where he is currently residing. Stephen, thank you very much for calling in.
Hi, Buck. Great to be with you.
Are we getting closer to a Russian incursion into Ukraine based upon what we're seeing at this point, or do you think that this is now trending more towards Putin getting what he wants without having to go to that extent? I mean, based upon sort of the heated rhetoric we're seeing, you know, President Obama's bouncing around in Asia saying everything's going to be just fine. Putin saying, you heard any Russians, I'm coming in. One, do you take him at his word? And two, do you think that's going to happen?
I think, number one, I do take Putin at his word, at least the word that he expresses to the Russian people and to the Russians who are basically the activists inside Ukraine. I don't take him at his word when he sends a diplomat like Lavrov off to Geneva to make an agreement that they have no intention of keeping. So we've got a little bit of a dichotomy in which part of Putin do we take at face value. I think that it's an important point that you have made repeatedly, that at this point, Putin has demonstrated a willingness to take territory and influences near abroad that puts the sovereign governments at great risk. And he doesn't have to take the rest of the Ukraine in order to have that dominant influence. He can dominate the Ukraine at any moment economically. He has proven that he can instigate a takeover of a large swath of the Ukrainian territory at any time. And he can sit back and pretend as if he doesn't know who's doing it or how they're doing it. Never once has he said that Russia won't accept any further territory from within the Ukraine.
Now, President Obama in the past...
Especially the eastern part of the country is at risk.
Right. President Obama in the past 24 hours of the news cycle made some comments on this, which I want to play for you, Stephen, and then I want to have you try to dissect the intent here. He's promising Russia that there will be further consequences. Of course, he said this in Japan. Play the clip.
If, once again, Russia fails to abide by both the spirit and the letter of what was discussed in Geneva, that there will be further consequences and we will ramp up further sanctions. What we try to do is to make sure that we are very clear about what we stand for, what we believe in, we are willing to take actions on behalf of those values, those norms, and those ideals. So far, at least, we have seen them not abide by the spirit or the letter of the agreement in Geneva. And instead, we continue to see militias and armed men taking over buildings, harassing folks who are disagreeing with them, and destabilizing the region, and we haven't seen Russia step up and discourage that.
Does President Obama even believe what he's saying now when he says things like there will be further consequences, or is this just essentially a recognition that he has to go through the motions on this, but they're just motions, and it's all talk, and this is like hope and change nonsense?
I have a hard time believing any of us in the rational world are taking that talk seriously. It's possible within the rare air of the Oval Office and the people close surrounding the president that they believe this stuff still, but certainly Putin doesn't. The threat of sanctions and further consequences has not altered his calculus or actions taken in any measurable way throughout this crisis, and it's actually a very troubling precedent when you look at the part of the world the president is visiting. In Asia, we have an untrustworthy and relatively unknown leader in North Korea that is testing limits. We have the Chinese, who have expansive territorial claims, and they might listen to, well, yeah, you threaten consequences and actions, but we have found no willingness anywhere in the world on your part to do anything meaningful. and we found lots of red lines written in invisible ink across the Arab Spring and elsewhere. And so I think the credibility of the president at this point is at an all-time low. He sounds really like a color commentary expert, more than a commander-in-chief when he's giving this kind of remark, talking about all of the sad things that are happening in the Ukraine, nothing about what we would really do. Now, the administration has done one important thing in finally having the Defense Department and the U.S. military support NATO moving resources into Poland and starting to have exercises. That doesn't change the calculus in Ukraine, but it's at least something that starts to show tangible support for other allies, and that is the first small step in a trend that's gone completely the other way.
Now, we heard from President Obama a second ago. I want to play a clip from Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, to give us, this was on Russia Today, the propaganda channel that they run in the U.S. Of course, cable distribution for Russia Today exceeds that of the Blaze TV, which is an outrage. However, I digress on that. Let's listen to what Lavrov had to say about his view of America right now and what's going on. Play that sound.
Well, I already said that it is not about Ukraine. Ukraine is just one manifestation of the American unwillingness to yield in the geopolitical fight. Americans are not ready to admit that they cannot run the show in each and every part of the globe from Washington alone. They cannot impose their ready-made solutions on everyone. And they cannot understand that, I mean, they begin to understand, I think, but they still have the instincts that they shouldn't really take on board what others believe should be done.
Stephen, it seems to me that that is kind of a summation of the Kremlin's point of view of America there. What do you think?
Well, I think it was a fantastic demonstration of psychological projection because no reasonable person would look at the Obama administration and his tenure in foreign policy and say that he has been activist about imposing the American way on multiple places around the world. If anything, much of our criticism is he's done too little to support those who seek self-determination or freedom in their own countries in their own ways, done too little to help those struggling for these qualities help themselves. But only in the Kremlin can they look at the situation in Ukraine and say it's been America trying to impose a foreign idea. It's the Russians who went in and who were activating their nationals, their assets, taking territory from a sovereign neighbor. They have been the revisionist power, but it's a fantastic and maybe even effective use of psychological projection from the Kremlin.
What happens now? Does the Obama administration just keep pretending that it has some sort of a policy here and Russia is able to essentially have a free hand? I mean, I know we've put some troops in Poland, which is a show of, I guess, a show of force, but it's not going to actually, I think, I mean, that's Poland. It's not Ukraine. I don't think it's going to change any calculations inside of Ukraine. Do you think that in sort of the, in the corridors of U.S. national security right now, you know, in the White House and over at the OEOB and all that stuff, that they've essentially written off Ukraine? Do you think that quietly they've said, you know what, we can't do anything about it and this is the way it's going to be?
I worry that that is the case. There is no evidence that the administration has any sense of purpose behind any of these challenges it faces in multiple regions. And in this one in particular, the prime mover in this crisis is Russia. And we have no sense of what we're prepared to do to meet that challenge. And the absence of recognizing the problem, framing it correctly, keeps us from having any reasonable agenda to push it back. So I think that Americans are war-weary, but the Russians are not weary, and they're on the march, and their march doesn't come cost-free to our allies and ourselves.
Steve Yates of DC International Advisors, also a candidate for office in Idaho. Your website is Yates for Idaho?
YatesforIdaho.com.
YatesforIdaho.com. Any Idahoans? Idahoans?
Idahoans.
Yeah. Idahoans. Thank you, sir. Sorry. Any Idahoans, you can go check that out there. Stephen Yates, thank you very much for calling in. Always good to talk to you, buddy. I appreciate it.
Anytime. Thank you, Buck.
Just wanted to bring to light here that even the left, even the editorial board of the Washington Post is saying that continued delay of Keystone XL is absurd. This is from the editorial board. It's just published yesterday. I just want to read you a little bit of this. If foot dragging were a competitive sport, President Obama and his administration would be world champions for their performance in delaying the approval of the Keystone XL pipeline. Last Friday afternoon, the time when officials make announcements they hope no one will notice, the State Department declared that it is putting off a decision on Keystone XL indefinitely, or at least, as it seems, well past November's midterm elections. This time, the excuse is litigation in Nebraska over the proposed route because that might lead to a change in the project that various federal agencies will want to consider. The State Department might even decide to substantially restart the environmental review process. This is yet another laughable reason to delay a project that the federal government has been scrutinizing for more than 5 years. Wow. Even on the left now, there's sort of this recognition that things can get too silly even to be swept under the rug for political reasons, that things can get so out of control, so beyond any rational perspective. And as we see here, Keystone XL has turned into exactly that. I think it's interesting. I've heard that there's the money issue here. There's some very big dollar donors. Of course, those big dollar donors, unlike the Koch brothers, those big dollar donors are great. There have been some money issues here that could factor into this going into the midterms. But really, on top of that, I think that there's a belief among some of the biggest players among the Democrats and on the left, there's a belief that the environment is so important that it might even transcend politics, meaning that even if you have to take some political lumps, even if it means you're going to give up a few seats, you're going to lose a few members of the House or maybe even lose a few Senate seats because of this kind of activity, it's worth it because the nonsense that they spout to all the rest of us, and I think many of them do it with a sort of cynicism, knowing that it's a way to expand big government and government control. But don't forget that there are true believers when it comes to Keystone XL. There are people who think that even though this will do nothing with regard to climate that's been shown by all the studies, that this is just a symbolic issue, that they don't want to allow this to go through because of how it will look, not what it will actually do. The optics of this for the environmental lobby, environmental religion, really, are such that they don't even care that this won't hurt the environment. They don't even care that this may hurt their chances to get legislation through that would protect and promote their environmental regulations. They just feel so deeply on this issue. They feel so deeply that they're willing to throw out so much other stuff with it. And I think it's just pretty amazing when you break it down that way. Let me just one more from this. This is from the Washington Post, by the way. One more from this piece. If activists want to make a real difference on carbon dioxide emissions, they should devote their energies to establishing an ambitious carbon price across Canada and in the United States. Oh, okay. Now we're back to what I would expect from the left. Just take more of people's money. Make energy more expensive. That's a more constructive way to do things. Let me just bring in Jay Severin real quick so he can give you guys a little taste of what's coming up on the Blaze Radio Network for the next 3 hours. Jay, what's going on?
Hey, Buck. How are you doing today?
Good, sir. How are you? What do you got planned for the folks?
Having listened
for people,
to what you just
folks.
Said, I think it is rather more the former than the latter. But if they want to go the kamikaze route for what they see as a matter of principle, I invite them. I'm happy to tie the little band around their head and give them the shot of sake or whatever they want. But it is the former to the degree that there's this one fellow, I don't know his name, I apologize, who has announced, his picture was on television last night, he's told Obama, and this news was reported this way, he's told Obama, if you don't do the pipeline, I'll give you $100 million in cash to fight to help keep the Senate for the Democrats.
Wow.
So that could be, I think we could, considering the way Obama thinks and works and the Democrats operate, that could be an inducement.
Sounds good. All right, Jay Severin up next. Guys, go to theblaze.com/Buck Sexton. Download that podcast. Play it on demand. Send it to friends. Send it to family. Spread it far and wide. Spread freedom. The Buck Sexton Show. Back tomorrow at noon. There'll be some Tommy Bear.
Buck Sexton. The Blaze Radio Network.